Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, all over the globe, world, international, intergalactic, wherever you happen to be while listening to this voice, this is Larry Charles, one half of the Game Dev Unchained podcast team. That's the number one podcast for video game development and the lifestyle of game developers. And this week, we scraped the bottom of the barrel. Just kidding. The guy who lives next to Lady Luck herself, Mr. Brandon Pham.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Coming out of the barrel here. This is Brandon Pham. Thank you for joining us this week. Please welcome our special guest, Jason Fader.
Jason.
Hello.
What's up, Jason? Man?
Happy to be here.
Happy to have you with us.
Yeah, it was good having you, man. This is the portion of the podcast where we ask a little bit about your background, if you don't mind introducing yourself to our audience.
Well, let's see. My grandparents emigrated from Russia shortly before World War One. Too far back? Okay, sorry. Let's see. So I've been in the game industry probably for the past 17 years or so. Got my start at Blizzard around the year 2000. So worked on Diablo 2, Warcraft 3. I worked on WoW. I was basically a tools programmer on a lot of projects there. Shortly after, I think about 6 months after WoW launched, left Blizzard to go do an indie thing. Made a small game with a bunch of college buddies called Red Space Hyperball. It was the 42nd game to ever come on Steam. So that was pretty cool. And then after that, I found myself at Obsidian working with Larry Charles, where I was on Fallout New Vegas and a few other projects. I was a lead producer at Obsidian and then parted ways, did the indie thing again, working on a Kickstarter called Steam Bandits, which I'm still working on, as you do with most Kickstarters these days. And about a year ago, I found myself at a company called Night Dive Studios as the game director of a System Shock reboot.
Hey, actually, that was probably the most concise, look over a resume that we've done on the podcast. So congratulations on that first as well.
Thank you.
Seriously, that was great.
Yeah, man, you obviously have worked at awesome places and been dipping your toes back in indie once in a while because the bug got you. So how was the first time versus the recent time? I mean, what would you say would be the difference?
I had less student loan debt the first time I did it. The first time I went indie, I was still living at home. Well, I guess living in my dad's place. And a bunch of my friends, we were fresh out of college. We decided to keep working on a student project that we were building up. So we left our day jobs, packed up all of our computers, moved it into my dad's dining room, and called up a bunch of friends that might have known people in the industry, got a hold of Valve, and got a really good relationship with them. Launched our game on Steam. It's a weird, weird game. There hasn't been anything out there like it. Super, super indie. Before there was even a category for indie games, I guess. It did moderately okay. Tried a lot of new things. It was basically like a real-time version of Worms in Space that was multiplayer and competitive. It was almost like a MOBA before there were MOBAs.
Nice.
Funny story, we actually had achievements in the game before there were Steam achievements. And since we had a really good relationship with Valve to wire all this stuff up, we were working with Valve to get all this stuff working. And then 6 months later, Valve comes out with Steamworks with achievements as well. Uh-huh. And I don't know if they got some of the ideas from us. I mean, probably they got it from Xbox, since Xbox was doing a lot of it. But yeah. It's one of those things where sometimes as a dev, you work on things internally, and then sometime later, like if you're working in Unreal or Unity, they come out with that feature and make what you're working on kind of obsolete.
To say the good thing is the players got achievements.
Yeah, yeah. And then going back to answering the question about the differences between indie back then and indie now. Indie now, there's so many tools out there. When I started doing indie stuff, this was back in 2006, Unity, Unreal were not there readily available. So we basically just coded up our own engine using DirectX, and we had amazing programmers. Those guys today, one of them, Nicholas Lawson, is a tech director or lead engineer over at Amazon working on Lumberyard. Mm-hmm. So these guys have we all stay in touch. Actually, we had lunch this week. We try to have lunch on a monthly basis just because we're still really good friends. But comparing all that to doing indie development now, it's kind of different. At least when you're an older developer that has bills to pay, everybody's moved away and has a lot of real world obligations. So it definitely makes it trickier. So if you ever want to go indie, the younger you do it, the safer it is.
Yeah. Well, speaking of young and kind of fearless, like reaching out to Valve at such an early part of your career and having and maintaining a good relationship with them, like that is a feat within itself. Like how about it did you guys go to reach out to those guys and get help?
Let's see. Oh man, I haven't thought about this one in a while. So one of the guys on our team, his name is Matthew Yeager, and his dad worked at Interplay for a while, and he had some friends, one of whom was a producer at Atari that we were working with on the game, and then they lined us up with a meeting with Valve where we pitched the game to them, told them about what we were doing. I was at GDC one year and had a face-to-face meeting with the guy who was running all their indie game stuff back then. What was his name? Jason Holtman. I think he's doing Oculus stuff now, and he's since left Valve. But yeah, after a few conversations, they felt like we would be a really cool fit for them. We were really early on their platform, so the guy we were talking to was basically the guy that was in charge of Steam. They didn't really have a large team back then. We basically developed the game over the span of a year, but working really close with Valve to make sure all their systems were working with our multiplayer stuff. Mm-hmm. Because not only was it a kind of a head-to-head dedicated server-based multiplayer game, but we also had kind of a persistent backend, almost like what you'd find in like Heroes of the Storm, where as you play games, you also gain levels and you can unlock things and all sorts of stuff we were trying that was crazy and new in 2006. But that's what you do when you're fresh out of college. You just do innovative things.
Yeah.
So looking at the perspective from being game number 46, right, on
42.
Steam. 42 on Steam to where it is now. Could you?
I will take that to my grave as an achievement.
Yeah. Let me ask you this: what's your view on the perspective of the growth of Steam, the platform? Right, like Steam is essentially the savior of PC gaming, as far as I'm concerned. Like I don't see people buying box copies of games anymore. It's just straight to Steam. Did you think, or even have any sort of inkling as to like going on Steam, being such an early adopter, was going to be like, you know, that Steam was going to grow into what it is today?
I did, but Atari didn't think so. So we got an amazing contract from them. So in the contract that we established with Atari, because they basically they fronted us some money to do development for the game. In the contract, they did not really think Steam was a big deal. Mm-hmm. But we did because we were gamers. And like back then, what was coming out? It was like Counter-Strike and Team Fortress Classic and a bunch of stuff like that. So we loved everything about Steam. And in the contract I negotiated with them, I retained all rights and all profits that went through Valve and Steam. Nice. Indefinitely. And Atari retained rights for brick and mortar sales and box copies.
That's one of those George Lucas deals.
Yeah, and I was fairly certain they weren't going to box it, and so having full profits on digital copies, yeah. It was just very forward thinking on my part, and it's own the IP for it completely, and it's still something that I like working on. So that's the other thing: if you go indie, try to retain the rights to your game as much as possible, because if you don't and you lose it, that's going to suck.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, seriously.
Yeah, any traction that you get with any type of game that you work on, I mean, it just helps to build off of that. So if you lose it, like, what's the point? Maybe you have the pedigree marketing that says, I made this, but yeah, I don't own it. But it definitely helps.
All right, so the reason why we have you here with us today is because we're hoping to get a little more information on this really cool game that we heard you're rebooting, which is System Shock. Now, you know, System Shock is a franchise that is coveted and it's protected by the industry, a cult classic even, you know. So I imagine there's a lot of people like with scrutiny and meticulously watching over the development of this project saying don't mess it up. So how, Mr. Jason Fader, do you feel taking on the role of directing this game under, you know, with all the fandom around such a classic game and then, you know, interpreting it and bringing it into 2017?
Well, I found a new appreciation in Top Shelf Hard Liquor, especially a really fancy rum that gets me through a lot of it. But no, it's intimidating and it's amazing. And I consider myself incredibly lucky in the industry. I've worked on Fallout and Warcraft based franchises, and it's a lot of stuff that has a built in established following with a lot of fans, very, very serious and passionate about it.
Passionate.
Good. Yeah, there's a lot of pressure because I don't want to let people down. All eyes are on us, and it can be overwhelming sometimes. But how I mitigate that is I'm as transparent as possible to the fans and community. For example, all of our Kickstarter backers are in our private Discord server. And I perhaps like chatting with them maybe too often. I don't know. I work remote, and when you work remote, you kind of lose touch with the real world. You don't get out as much, and friendships tend to diminish. I think the extent of most of my friendships now is just like posts on Facebook, and I think they know I still care. But I've never been good at maintaining friendly connections, but I still like having friends, In the Discord server with the fans, I basically sometimes if I'm working at a coffee shop designing some aspect for the game, I'll chime in there and just say, hey, you know, here's a cool little quirk thing that I just researched about science, and I'm going to be applying this to Shodan in some weird way. And then they'll engage in that and start having a conversation with me. We have channels in there where they can directly leave feedback, and some of them ping me and ask what I'm thinking about for a certain feature. And if it's something I'm ready to talk about, I just completely tell them here's what I'm planning and here's what's going to be in the game. And if it's something that is kind of unknown right now, I'm not going to commit to features before they're set in stone, because that's just setting yourself up for failure. But I'm honest with them. I basically say it's too early to tell, but as far as where I'm leaning towards, I really like games that do these sorts of things. And so since that's where my interests fall, that's probably where things are going to end up with this game.
So as a fan, though, that's the most incredible relationship you could expect to have with a developer, especially if they're working on something you're excited about. Now, I know you come from like Blizzard and working on some of the big franchises there, you know, working on Fallout New Vegas, where a lot of these big companies are more clandestine about what they do. I guess comparing and contrasting your experiences as a developer on either end, do you feel like the shift is going towards being more open about game development, or is that better? Do you have a specific opinion on which one you enjoyed more, I guess, for the entire community?
I think it just depends on the company culture. I don't think there's necessarily a wrong way to do it. I mean, well, yes, there is. Completely ignoring your fans and not talking to them is really wrong. Mm-hmm. But as far as what you reveal for market timing, there's pros and cons to both. Since we started as a Kickstarter, it's very important to me to be communicating often with our fans, answering their questions, because they're invested in this as much as we are. Mm-hmm. And it would be a disservice to them to ignore that. And so it's very important to me and the rest of the team to maintain that constant level of communication, that transparency, always hearing them out. And they'll give us ideas and pitch us on features they'd like to see. Not everything we actually move forward with, but we listen to everything. And to us, that's the most important part of our relationship with our fans, is that we actually listen.
Hmm. Like how difficult was it? Because I was reading something the other day, and this happens a lot in the movie industry. Did you have to go through loops to get the rights to do this and stuff? Like, what was that?
I didn't, because that happened before I joined the team.
Okay.
However, the CEO of Night Dive Studios, Stephen Kick, yes, he has. Yeah, it took him a while, but his hard work paid off, and he acquired the rights to it. There's articles that have been written on it, but the short story is, after Looking Glass shut down, the rights fell to an insurance holding company, and then our CEO did the homework, did a lot of research, did the chatting with them, got some contracts going, and eventually got System Shock 2 on Steam and the original System Shock on Steam, and was able to acquire the rights from them and do all sorts of stuff, and even licensed the rights to System Shock 3 to Warren Spector and Paul Neurath from Other Side to do their thing, and we're doing our thing, rebooting the original, and it's a pretty awesome process. I'm really glad that I didn't have to do any of that legwork beforehand, because that just sounded way too tedious and boring. I would much rather just stay on the creative side.
Yeah, that sounds great, man. Like, just the ability to do that, and like, it's, I'm sure it was like an uphill battle, but for studios or that insurance company to be able to negotiate and work something out is definitely a service to the fans and to gamers out there. Yeah. Because you hear it all the time in Hollywood, like, even there's like a fan made Voldemort from the Harry Potter series movie coming out that got kickstarted. And then, you know, of course, Warner Brothers is like, no, wait, hold on. But thankfully, it's allowed to go on, which is rarely the case. So in video games, man, I would imagine the same type of loops have to be conquered and negotiated to get to this point. I mean, how long was that process?
I think a few years, maybe 3 years or so, back and forth. I'm not entirely sure. Mm-hmm. Definitely more time than I myself would have patience for.
Right.
Yeah. That's one thing about the game industry. It's like all the spiritual successors, if they didn't go through the red tape to secure rights, 99.9% of those projects got shut down, right? Like all the games that are like, hey, fan-made versions of some sort of IP that exists, shut down, shut down, shut down. Mm-hmm. But obviously in this case, as Jason said, no, he, you know, like at Night Dive Studios, they contacted all the legal representatives who own the IP. They did the research. They did the legwork. They made connections, rubbed elbows, and they eventually acquired the rights to do this. So I guess that's the difference, audience, is doing the legwork, making a project, getting a lot of people excited, and then being told you can't do it.
So, Jason, were you a part of the Kickstarter campaign, or did you join after?
I joined about, I think about 2 or 3 weeks before the Kickstarter campaign started. So I was involved for a good chunk of the Kickstarter campaign process. But by then, a lot of the wheels had been set in motion. So, funny story, actually. I didn't realize how soon their Kickstarter campaign was going to be starting until I actually joined the team. And the Kickstarter overlapped my trip to Comic-Con. Every year, I love going to Comic-Con. Spending a week there is the only vacation I ever give myself. And last year at Comic-Con, I think I spent about 70% of my time just managing the Kickstarter, going back and forth, talking to the backers, and planning things out with all the backer rewards and everything. And I didn't really get to enjoy my Comic-Con, but I mean, it was also kind of worth it, because all the work that I was putting in helped to everybody's work helped make that Kickstarter the success that it was. So this year, Comic-Con, blocking out time, not going to let anybody bother me. I'm going to make up for it, and I'm just going to enjoy my week.
All right. What costume are you wearing this year?
I don't really cosplay, because it's really warm down there. I mean, my girlfriend's going to be cosplaying something from Pokemon, and she's trying to convince me to. I don't know. I think if I were to cosplay something, it would probably be something from Avatar: The Last Airbender. Actually, Legend of Korra, Tenzin, because, you know, goatee, bald hair. It's, you know, probably a good fit.
Nice. Just wondering.
Was there a... has this been your second Kickstarter you were mentioning before?
This is not my first rodeo, and there were a lot of similarities as far as no matter how prepared you think you are for a Kickstarter, as Illidan would say, you are not prepared.
You are not prepared.
There's always things that you didn't account for, curveballs that are thrown your way. It's really a test of a team's resolve to see a Kickstarter through and to make the fans as happy as possible and to communicate as well as they can what they're going to be making.
Were there any standouts from both situations where you felt like, holy crap, didn't even think about this as a team. All right, this is how we fix it.
Well, one of the big differences when I did a Kickstarter, back in 2012, it didn't raise as much as the System Shock Kickstarter for sure, and did not have the volume of backers that System Shock has. So it was much easier to manage from a communication standpoint, keeping up with the backers and the messages that would get sent in. But for the System Shock Kickstarter, flooded with so many messages, so many backers asking questions that we were overwhelmed. There weren't really a lot of us on the team. I think at the time there were maybe about six of us, but we would get maybe 20 or 30 messages a day. Sometimes up to, I think that one time we got up to 50 messages towards during like the beginning and the end of the Kickstarter, and just managing messages and responding to comments, it became essentially a full-time job, to the point where had to have some of the team just not look at the Kickstarter and keep working on their stuff because things still needed to get done for the game.
All right.
Jesus, man. So I have three quick questions about Kickstarter for you. I want to see if you can help our audience in 5 minutes or less. Question number one, do you believe in shipping physical media to Kickstarter backers?
Yes, but not too much of it. Physical media can be very expensive, and it's a logistical hurdle. I definitely recommend, if you want to do physical rewards, to align with some third party that specializes in fulfillment, because it'll just save you a lot of headache.
Question number two, do you believe in asking for how much money you need or how much money you want?
It depends, but either way, you should always be honest and transparent with your fans about what you're looking for. It's called Kickstarter, not Kick Finisher. So sometimes some projects start there to get to the prototype stage and then pitch that prototype onto a publisher. Some MMOs that start on Kickstarter operate that way. Others are asking for enough money to finish the entire game. As long as you're clear with what it is you're asking for, there's no real wrong approach. You just need to make sure that the backers are fully aware of what it is they're putting their money towards and what to expect and by when.
My final question for you, sir, is how soon do you begin telling people about your Kickstarter?
Market timing is tricky. You definitely want to give yourself, I would say, at least a 30-day head start to start making noise. Sooner is always better, just to kind of tease it. But you want to have that critical mass as early as possible on that first day when that Kickstarter launches, so that you have fans ready to go that know what you're going to be making, that are ready to back you. That way you can reach your funding goal as quickly as possible, because the more a project has been funded, the more confidence backers that are on the fence may have for actually backing that project.
Thank you. I love that. That was awesome, man.
Okay.
Yeah.
Totally unrehearsed.
A new segment, like rapid fire, real quick. Fast five questions or something.
Hard talk even with Larry Charles. Three,
seriously. We'll try it again next week. But yeah, thanks, man. I'm going to start a Kickstarter one day. So I keep asking Kickstarter questions, trying to help myself, really. But the audience is, you know, fly on the wall since they listen to the podcast. So like, they get the information as well.
So you guys started, it sounded like six people when you kickstarted. I mean, how big is the team now?
Oh, boy. there's about 25 of us now, roughly.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, you guys ramped up quick. I mean,
we're still in pre-production. All right. It's not even, it's not even our final form.
Oh,
yeah, we're still in pre-production. So it's a lot of senior folks. The leads team has been established, working on a lot of pre-production things. And then once we enter production, the team size will probably be close to 35 to 40.
Oh, nice. That's good size.
So let me ask you this, because I saw the Kickstarter. I think you guys were asking for 900,000 and you pulled in about 1.3. Mm-hmm. Are you looking, and I might just be ignorant to where you guys are in the project right now, but are you looking for a publisher to come in and, you know, drop some like significant revenue behind this, or is the 1.3 all you need to take it to the finish line?
Well, 1.3 is enough to definitely make the game, but there's that old adage of throwing more money at something typically results in something being better. I mean, not always. There are some Kickstarters out there that have raised a stupid amount of money that may never see the light of day, unfortunately. But Other than that, I mean, as far as publishers in general, publishers provide a lot of useful services. For example, QA, localization, putting it on store shelves, stuff that Night Dive right now is not well equipped to handle. So I would say a publisher alignment is definitely not off the table. I don't particularly have an interest in managing an entire QA team. So it'd be nice if there was somebody else that can handle that. Yeah, we'll see.
Awesome, man. Well, if you feel like throwing some of that our way, you know, feel free. We always appreciate support.
Yeah, we like pocket change.
What's one of the biggest surprises, though, that you guys found as far as, you know, trying to do a true restart or reboot of a franchise from, you know, the early 90s to actually doing it and updating it in 2017?
The biggest surprises. I would say gauging what the fans' interest levels were. Like most games that came out back in the day, there's still a loyal following, people that believe very strongly in the project. We did a lot of homework, and we still do. We check up on all the fan forums, see what their thoughts are. There was a very large community on a website with diehard fans, and they created, I don't want to call it a manifesto, but it was more of a document of collected ideas and suggestions from the most loyal fans and diehard fans.
Oh, nice.
And
those are actually in the game. You don't have to say what went in, but like what percent.
Well, it's not what's going in the game, but rather how surprised I was when I read the things that they were saying.
There you go.
Because I thought that the most diehard fans would want things maintained as a one-to-one conversion of the original, change as little as possible, and no deviations. But instead, from their collected collaboration and feedback, it was almost the opposite, where their rationale was, there's so many people out there that have not appreciated System Shock as they did back in the 90s, and it hasn't aged entirely well. And their suggestions were to not worry about making them happy, because they've already experienced it for the first time back then. And instead, they encouraged us to find the best way to represent the true core and spirit of System Shock to today's gamers. And it was overwhelming, we just felt incredibly grateful that we almost got the blessing of the fan and community base to not try to service their needs, but instead to think about those that never got to play System Shock in the past, and instead give them the best first time experience possible. And that was the most unexpected thing. Wow. Because I mean, working on Fallout and other games, I'm used to fans being very, I don't want to say, serious but definitely
particular.
Yeah, very, very particular about what they want, and I couldn't have predicted how awesome this community has been to us and how encouraging they are in almost, like I said, giving us their blessing to make this game something that everybody can appreciate, not just a game for them. Then again, I think that crew is probably also more mature and older than your typical gaming crew, because I mean these are folks that appreciated the game in the 90s, and so it's just good to see that there's still good-natured hardcore fans on the internet.
Awesome, and that's rare though. It's like the fans that I usually interact with these days are like complaining on YouTube that, you know, Call of Duty did this or BioShock did that, and it's just like, Jesus Christ, guys, the game's not even out yet, and you know, you seem like you've already played it and know every secret that these guys have to offer.
I'm sure we'll probably still run into those, but they've been very few and far between. I would say a majority of the fan base has been a real joy to communicate with.
Awesome. Now, is there a specific part about the game that you yourself are the most excited about? Like, oh, you know, this is something that we added and put on, that you can talk about, that you kind of want to say, like, man, you know, we really took it to the next level with this, you know?
I think I will have a different question whenever you ask me, whenever I'm asked that at a certain point in time, because it will always be whatever feature I'm currently working on is my favorite feature in the world. That's just how I design things, is I just completely immerse myself in that environment and I fall in love with it. And I treat it as great as I can. And right now I'm working on a lot of lore, historical stuff, thinking really, really getting into Shodan's mind and just figuring out a lot of stuff regarding her background, how she was feeling on the station, why she did what she did, and basically just connecting all the dots. And that itself is not necessarily a feature, but it's what forms the foundation of the game, because I can't think of a whole lot of games out there where the villain or the antagonist is there with you every step of the way, taunting you. Every action the player is going to take that Shodan notices, she's going to have a response. She's going to troll you. She's going to make fun of you. And there's going to be this weird frenemy-enemy relationship going on in the player's mind versus this villain that they're eventually going to take down. But on that road to do it, it's not just going to be an end boss that you see at the very end of the game that you've never seen before. It's going to be somebody that has been there with you from the beginning, that's been taunting and pissing you off, and it's going to feel great when you finally take her down because she has it coming.
Hell yeah. Sounds like she's the cousin of GLaDOS or some shit, man.
Actually, a lot of GLaDOS, she's been based on Shodan. In some ways, there are some fan fictions and webcomics out there that show GLaDOS as the daughter of Shodan, and it's adorable. Yeah.
That joke was for the youngins who weren't around for 28.8 modems and System Shock.
Mm-hmm. So when did a System Shock come out?
1984.
And then
next trivia question.
So remastering a classic, and you were mentioning before the balancing of keeping what was memorable and updating what to today's standards of shooters. I mean, how has that been balancing those type of features and respecting the original?
It's tricky, but it's, if you've played the original System Shock, it's clear that there are some aspects to it that have not aged very well. So it mm-hmm. became clear graphics definitely need an overhaul. Some of the game design decisions with usability, a lot of UX and UI design definitely needs an overhaul. It's what we did when we started the project is we played through the first game a lot, and then basically analyzed what still holds up and what could use some more massaging and some more love. And what we concluded was the story's awesome. The story, the characters, the content itself is so rich and amazing. I'm amazed that they were able to achieve so much in so little time back then. And so we're trying to preserve as much of the spirit of that as we possibly can, but bringing it into a modern engine like Unreal and utilizing a lot of the really cool physics and visual fidelity that Unreal has to offer, basically making a modern version of System Shock that utilizes everything that we've learned over the last 20 years when it comes to game development and applying that to this classic. And it's challenging at times, but it's ultimately... the best rule of thumb that I tend to follow is I picture the game in my mind, and I picture playing through, running down the corridors of Citadel Station, it still gels very well together. Right now, we're also doing playthroughs of System Shock 2 to just get everything in our heads and figure out what everybody appreciated about the whole franchise of System Shock games to make sure that we're doing the best we possibly can to this amazing, amazing game universe.
So I want to ask this question because it sounds like there might be a story here, but I remember when I watched the Kickstarter video, I guess I left with the impression that the game was being developed in Unity, but I know now that it's actually being developed in Unreal. So was there a big story in the transition as to why it happened and what was that like, I guess, or were you just being trolled?
There's a few reasons. So we announced our switch to Unreal when we were up at GDC, but we had actually started investigating Unreal a few months after the Kickstarter. So after the Kickstarter was funded, we looked at the entire roadmap, the game that we wanted to make, the scope of everything. It was still a very small team, so we needed to also ramp the team up. And as we were ramping the team up, folks that we were bringing onto the team had a great deal of Unreal experience, more so than Unity. And it became clear that there was interest in Unreal. So we had meetings with both Epic and Unity to talk about what our needs were, what we were envisioning for the game. We had a lot of meetings with our team to just talk about how would our development time look in each engine, how can we push performance and visual fidelity. for console development, Unreal definitely seemed to fit our needs more as far as performance, hitting a consistent frame rate and awesome fidelity with performance, and also playing to the strengths of the team that we were building. Mm-hmm. Most of our leads have a background in Unreal. We have guys that that worked on Mass Effect and Dragon Age and the Old Republic and a bunch of stuff, and it was just playing more and more to Unreal based technology. So it just made sense for us to make that transition just to make our own development a lot easier.
So as a designer myself, talking to another designer, I'm going to ask a question on behalf of all the designers out there is, how did you yourself get into the no, it's not going to be a hard one, but how did you prepare for the opportunity to lead the development of System Shock's reboot?
How did I do it? I pet my cat a lot, and I looked deep into her eyes, and I asked my cat, Trillian, and I said, Trillian, am I ready for this? Can I do this? And she didn't really know I was talking to her, and she just kind of ignored me, as cats are known to do. So then I concluded I needed to answer that question myself. I wasn't sure. One of the things that I try to be as egoless as possible, because I've worked with quite a few folks in the industry that have nothing but ego, and I don't want to be that. So I'm always doubting myself, and I think that's natural. The best way to overcome that is to get validation from your peers. And so when I was joining the project, I immediately started writing. I wrote my ideas down, my thoughts, what System Shock meant to me, what I would do, and essentially pitched it to the team and my closest friends to get their feedback, to kind of sanity check myself. Like, Emma, is this nuts? Emma, are these bad ideas? Am I just a 2-bit hack? What do you guys think? Everybody loved it. They thought I was on point, and they were really great ideas in a great direction. And that helped give me internal confidence to motivate myself and do and create even better work. So I would say if you ever have any doubts or you're not sure if you can achieve something, put some work in, seek validation or criticism from peers. Try to avoid friends and family, because they're never going to tell you you're dumb, unless you have friends that do that, and then they might not really be friends.
What's up, Larry?
But try to find colleagues, game development forums, places where it's unbiased feedback, and that is incredibly valuable. And if you can find that validation that and that reaffirms your suspicion that you might know what you're doing, then you're probably on the right track.
Yeah. I think all of us have worked with that guy who's still in love with himself or herself, right? Let's just be genderless here. Both genders can be assholes, all right? But yeah, I mean, it's refreshing to hear that from a game director like yourself, just coming from a humble place. And, you know, we're making games. I feel like a lot of times people forget that and get so political about things and don't think about, you know, the goodness for the whole team. And, you know, whatever the best choices are, it's more like, yeah, you are the head of a department, but it's more like, you know, I'm just managing this right now, but everyone can contribute and help each other out in any way. So, I mean, I think the way you're handling is perfect.
I'm envious of those out there that can really sell themselves, market themselves, and convince others they know what they're doing. That's a great skill. But that's not typical for most people. I tend to keep my head down and do my work. And so I'm not always quick to be on Twitter and have a lot of followers. But that's not important to me. That's not how I measure my own worth. I measure my worth by what I do, not what I say. And you'll always be your own harshest critic. And so the most important thing is to learn how to appreciate yourself and to appreciate your own work, because you're going to make crappy work if you hate yourself. So don't.
Man, I gotta stop hating myself. So E3 coming right around the corner. I always say that E3 and GDC are my favorite times of the year for actually games and developers. And, you know, you had mentioned that you spend, you know, at least once a month, you try to get back together with some of your old friends. Now, how well have you been able to maintain your network of colleagues, or at least close professional friends, over the years? Because you've had a lengthy career thus far.
I would say very horribly, though maybe not so much. A week and a half ago, I had lunch with Frank Kalikowski.
Frank. Yeah. Yes, he is. Shout out to Frank and Blizzard.
A few months ago, I had lunch with Megan Parks. I still talk to Dan Rubalcaba. I ran into Justin Renard at a party a few weeks ago. I don't really go out of my way to maintain friendships. It just accidentally maintains itself by running into people in common circles. And whenever I see somebody that I've worked with, I give them a huge old bear hug. I love everybody, and I try not to make enemies. I really care what people think about me. I'm very, very self-conscious with that stuff. And I enjoy people's company, which is weird because I also don't like going out much. So I'm a huge contradiction. But yeah, with E3, I'm horrible at maintaining connections at events. I don't think I have asked to meet with anybody other than what I need to do for work. I tend to be very antisocial. Like I said, I'm horrible at selling myself. But if I see somebody I know, I'm going to get really excited and I'm going to hug them like crazy. But I'm not going to go out of my way to set up a meeting. That's almost outside of my
hug is all you get. Okay, just yeah. Let it be known.
you're a spontaneous hugger and not a planned hugger. So
no, that makes it more meaningful that way.
Yeah, I mean it's one of those. At least talking about maintaining connections and relationships and stuff, like. Post Kickstarter campaign, it's kind of like closed curtains and like what happens behind the scenes. And you were mentioning before, you're talking a bit about Discord and you're talking to the fans and maintaining that. And do you guys have a dedicated person that interacts? You know, usually we have community managers that interact and does this. Is the whole team involved in this process, or how are you guys handling it?
One of our producers on the team, her public facing name is Carly Meow. She's also our community manager. Her job is part of her job is to keep up with what the community is saying. And if there's an important question or something that needs our attention, she'll let one of our devs know and either get an answer from them or get them to answer the question directly. Her part of her day-to-day tasks are to stay on top of everything everybody is saying and ensure that the fans, community, they're getting their questions answered. Sometimes, I mean, I also kind of help after hours and I check out what's going on in Discord if there's any chatter going on, because I just like also talking to the fans. But it's certainly a lot of communication traffic that happens. So we have somebody dedicated for that.
I guess with where you guys are on the project and how much you have left to do, you know, I know that the excitement can build up over time, but do you ever feel like because you communicate so much, because fans now start to expect that there's going to be new conversations, dialogue, or content that they get to interface with you on a daily, monthly, or weekly basis that, you know, you may not be able to fulfill? Has it ever bitten you in the butt, or do they just understand like, hey, look, I have content when I do, and when I don't, I don't, you know, what's that like?
It hasn't backfired yet, and I think a good example is last week, I had a lot of documents I needed to finish, but there was questions being asked in Discord that I really wanted to answer. And so I hopped into Discord, answered the questions as quickly as I could, and then I immediately said, sorry, guys, I got to get back to work. It's a really busy week for me. And they said, totally understand it. Go make a great game. Thank you for popping in and answering our questions. Good luck, Jason. And I was like, thank you. Thank you for your support.
It's definitely rewarding. I mean, engaging your audience and your customers from day one has been, if anything, the last 5 years or since the smartphones came out has been huge for us. Like Twitch within the last 10 years exploded for that reason. Just every second, indie developers especially are broadcasting every minute, or some of them are even doing 24 hours live broadcasts of them developing, which I don't know what that looks like still. I have no interest at staring at my coworkers for 24 hours. It's like, it's nothing interesting to me, but to some people it's like a peek inside of game development. And so I think as an indie developer, we definitely appreciate it more. than, you know, when we're working at bigger studios and we're kind of just, you know, eyes on the monitor, nose down, and just completing our work and then going home. It's like, it's a nice break kind of being involved and, like most indie developers would say, in the whole process and just seeing what everyone does a little and just appreciating everything that, you know, your customers are.
Yeah. And are. To my recollection, I've always been this way in the game industry. Looking back to the first indie game I made, Hyperball, wow, the 10-year anniversary is coming up this July. And I still talk to that community. We have a Discord server and there's still some loyal fans that pop in, and I'm actually going to be playing a few rounds of the game with them this Thursday.
Nice.
I don't know. I don't like going out in public, but I love interacting with people online. It's, I don't know, keeping people at a physically safe distance because I just have social anxiety or something.
Yeah.
Well, are you going to do anything special for the anniversary of your game?
I mean, to be honest, System Shock is taking up a lot, pretty much all my time. Gotcha. But I'm trying to carve out a few hours at the end of the day, at least a few hours a week, to start thinking about something that I would like to do with that game, because there's never been a game out there like it. I think it could still hold up. And I still talk to the original dev team because we're just really, really close friends. And so, yeah, maybe. We'll see. I mean, it's not going to be something I'm going to set a deadline to. It's just going to be kind of a side hobby thing. But I don't know. I love every project I've worked on. And I always want to – there's always more that I want to do. It's just a matter of finding the time to do it. So I think my biggest problem is I just don't know how to give up. And I'm not gonna Rickroll quote or anything, but I don't know. I just love making games, and I just wish there was more time in a day, and I didn't need sleep.
And it's so inspiring to hear people say, like, I wish I had more time to work on my work.
Well, so you guys are remastering System Shock.
Rebooting.
Sorry. My bad. Rebooting System Shock. At the same time, you know, the other team is co-developing System Shock 3. Is there a level of interaction between the two? Because obviously there's a benefit to both doing really well.
Oh yeah, definitely. There's a form of collaboration. At GDC, I got to meet Warren Spector in person. Nice. Because most of our other interactions have mostly been online. He lives in Austin, and he's a really, really cool guy. And I felt very unprofessional because I couldn't hold back. I had to fanboy at him about Deus Ex because it's one of my favorite games of all time. And he was really humble about it, very appreciative. Such a great, nice guy. I really love chatting with them.
I look forward to, you know, seeing Jason Fader being held in such regard, especially after this project is out. All it's going to take is you do well on this. I'll be at your GDC talk, buddy.
I don't need the fame. I just want people to learn from my mistakes and my successes.
Yeah.
What was the biggest mistake you made in your career?
Discord. Yeah. What? Sorry. Say that again.
I was saying, what was the biggest mistake you made in your career, if you don't mind me asking? That people can learn from, not like a sad, depressing one, but like one that can be turned into a lesson.
It's hard to say because every mistake that I think that I think my biggest mistake was not realizing that it's okay to fail. Mm-hmm. Oh, and that might be a little too meta, but it's true. The more you fail, the more you learn. You shouldn't try to fail, but you shouldn't see your failures as defeat, because as long as you're learning from it and not repeating your mistakes, you're on the path towards success. People that fail are people that have tried something. They've taken a risk. People that have never failed haven't tried hard enough. They haven't gone risky enough. So don't look at failures as the end of it. Failures are just a stepping stone. It's a learning process, and don't be afraid of it. I was afraid of failing, and that fear of failure probably held back some interesting opportunities that could have gone my way. And I have failed a bit, but I've learned from everything that I failed in, and I'm still learning. And not to tangent, but I think one of my favorite things about game development, at least these days, especially with so much information at our fingertips, is learning new things that have nothing to do with game development. So for example, for System Shock, I had to research a crap load about how the brain works, genetics, the latest advancements in prosthetics, because I basically needed to convince myself how I would physically make a cyborg. I wanted to be as scientifically plausible as possible. And it's that research, it's that learning stuff. Like, here's a factoid. Did you know that taking grapefruit with medication is almost equivalent to drinking alcohol with medication? So don't eat grapefruit with your meds, because there's an enzyme in there that can mess with things.
I need to stop doing that.
You know, what's messed up is, like, there's people listening right now who are like, bullshit, and they're going to go try it.
Look it up.
Try it out.
Speaking grapefruit juice.
But yeah, it's the side facts that you learn and the research, because I was a horrible student, and I don't, and maybe that's why I really love learning now, because I never got great grades, but I like learning new things, and I think that's the coolest side effect of game development is you're always learning, and it's really good to keep sharp on things.
Well, Mr. Fader, I have a hard time believing that 90% of your time goes to BioShock. I know your cat, System Shock. I know your cat takes up the other 5%, and your girlfriend obviously is in the equation as well.
Yes.
But where in that little sliver of personal time do you find yourself doing activities that you just enjoy that are non-game related, besides like researching? Like, hey, Larry, you know, I'm in a bowling league now. I'm in a barbershop quartet.
Actually, I was in a barbershop quartet in high school.
Oh, see?
Actually, another one of my problems is I do volunteer a lot for organizations. I'm currently the chapter president of the Orange County IGDA.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your contribution and keeping that going.
I like giving back. I like sharing what I've learned. I mean, I feel like, I don't know, if I die tomorrow, I'll die happy knowing that I've at least taught somebody something. Just having some kind of a legacy so people can learn from me and not have to reinvent the wheel, not have to repeat mistakes that others have made. I feel that's how we're going to progress as a society, is by learning from one another. I also volunteer for a local LARP.
lightning bolt. That's all I can think of.
Throwing spell packets that consist of beanbags filled with birdseed. I volunteer for a yearly masquerade ball that's up in LA called Labyrinth of Jareth.
Oh, nice.
I don't know. I like being parts of organizations and helping. I like being a part of something great. So I try not to take on more than I can feasibly handle. I'm pretty sure I'm at the limit of things that I can volunteer for. But I find it very fulfilling. I'm always busy. But I always make time for the people in my life that I love. It's a delicate balance, but yeah, I think I'm pulling it off okay. My girlfriend's still hanging around with me, doesn't seem to be too upset by the long hours. So I don't know. Hopefully I'm doing something right.
Amen, man.
Well, I mean, speaking of making time, like, how is the studio set up?
So it's fully remote. There's people spread out across the country and a few people even in Europe. Thanks to modern technology, we're using stuff like Google Hangouts to coordinate our online meetings. We use Slack for text-based communication, Google Docs and Google Drive for coordinating a bunch of files. We use SVN for version control, but probably eventually we'll switch to Perforce because Perforce is just really, really good. Yeah, there's a lot of online tech out there to make a virtual office environment very efficient and productive. And we have a really, really good production team that keeps on top of the schedule, everybody's tasks, ensure everybody is focused and on track. Yeah, we're making it happen. I'm pretty sure with everything that we're figuring out with all this online technology, we'll probably give a GDC talk on that alone.
Yeah, like seriously, I've been so interested in the virtual studio infrastructure because mostly in studios that I've had issues with has been because I was in the studio. Like you take away the people, you take away PTO, you know, all this stuff. You make up your own hours. You know, some people work better at 10 p.m. versus 10 a.m. You know, I mean, how has that? Is this your first time? Well, obviously not your first time. You've been a bunch of indie developer team, but like to the people who haven't tried it, like what would you say to them, and like to sell them this idea? And
it's awesome and it sucks.
Yeah.
It's awesome because of the flexibility. I get to hang out with my cat every day. It's great. if I'm feeling visually fatigued from working at home, I can pick up my laptop, go to a Starbucks and continue working. I am a fully mobile, on the move game developer if I need to be. It's really cool. The downside, though, is that I don't really see humans that often physically. I miss working in an office. I miss the team camaraderie in person. I miss going out for drinks after work, lunchtime gaming, just like having movie nights with the team. Though, funny story, my team's kind of solved the movie nights problem remotely. We actually had our holiday party online. Nice. what we did was there's a website called rabbit.io, or I think it's just rab.it now. And if you go on Rabbit, it's basically like Twitch for videos. Oh, nice. So everybody hops into a room that somebody is hosting, and they navigate to Netflix or Hulu, queue up a movie, and then everybody, similar in a Google Hangout, they can have their webcams on, their mics on, and they're all watching the same video feed. And what did we watch for our holiday break? We watched Jason X, because it was a sci-fi horror thing. It was really getting it was kind of similar visually a little bit to some System Shock stuff, and we were drinking and having a lot of fun. And then after we saw the movie, we all hopped into a game of Overwatch and had fun. And yeah, that was essentially our holiday party. And the best thing was, like, nobody had to Uber home because they were already home.
Yeah.
And then last week we had another movie night where we saw The Fifth Element together because it was the Fifth Element anniversary. Mm-hmm. And so there's little things that, thanks to modern technology, that we can do to keep the team closer together. But it's still not a perfect replacement for physically working in the same location as other people. And I do miss it. But like I said, it's awesome and it sucks.
Mm-hmm. You got a taste of what work life is going to be like for your grandkids, man. I swear the virtual office is going to be on a rise. I see the trend continuing. That's just going to be the norm, though. You know, I have a feeling for as many people that work in office, there's going to be as many people working out of office.
Yeah, I like the... Like, you can hop on a plane and start working from Hawaii. I mean, that's the biggest draw right there.
Well, I think most planes... well, the Wi-Fi is probably expensive.
Right.
So, not sure you're really going to get the best connection.
But, yeah, I mean, like, just... I think the flexibility and being a game developer... And, yeah, I do get what you're saying. Like, being in the office and messing with people... on a daily basis is part of the fun.
Nerf gun battles. Yeah.
No, I get it.
There's only so many times you can shoot the webcam before people like don't react anymore.
Right.
Or it's somebody's birthday and there's a birthday cake in the office. Now everybody gets free cake.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are certain aspects that I do love about being in the office for sure. But I guess it's like the grass is greener type of situation. I think we need to switch places once in a while.
There's pros and cons to everything.
There's pros and cons to everything,
Well, gentlemen, if you notice, I have this really nice pocket watch right here. And I was looking at the time, and it says, Mr. Fader, you have successfully been podcasting with us for over an hour.
Holy crap. And this is my first podcast ever, by the way.
Hell yeah. Wow.
Thanks for popping another my podcast, Perry.
Yeah, there we go.
Hey, thanks for giving it to us.
Yeah. You're not our first anyways.
That's fine. You're more experienced. I'm cool with it.
How it always works, man. So look, without further ado, though, I want to let you know that we always let our guests come on and talk directly to the audience to promote, to broadcast, to shout out, or raise awareness for something special that they're involved in or that they just want our audience to know more about. And, you know, you're not special. You get the same treatment. So have at it.
Just what I like to hear. let's see. System Shock is a great game. We're rebooting it. If you'd like to know more, go to systemshock.com. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, it's just at Jason Fader. I work on other projects. Hopefully, I'll be making more noise with some of my indie stuff. We'll see. Just follow me on Twitter if you'd like to know more of that information. There's going to be Steam sales coming up with some games that I've worked on in the past. I'm sure Fallout New Vegas will probably be on sale. Thread Space Hyperball is going to be on sale. Geez, what else to spread more awareness of? I don't know. Take this moment to internally reflect on yourselves and be happy with yourself because you're awesome deep down.
Namaste. Well, Mr. Fader, Mr. Fram to my right, it's been a great podcast. I'm saying goodnight.
This is Brandon Fan. Thanks for listening this week. See you guys next week.
Bye.
Thought there was three words in here.
There we go. All right.
If you enjoyed this podcast and you want to stay in touch or continue to follow our developments, then you need to go to facebook.com/GameDevUnchained and drop a like and stay in touch. You can also get the direct feed for this podcast on soundcloud.com/GameDevUnchained.